Today, we are moving on to the experiment we're supposed to have been covering. And I know that we still need to talk about the calculations for the grain salt experiment. And no, I won't wait till the very last moment so that they're all piled on you all at the same time. But because we're in the kinetics chapter right now, it just makes so much sense that we hurry up and get to what we classically call the iodine clock experiment. So I think this is called the kinetics experiment online. It's experiment number 3 in terms of the sequential numbering. And it is a classic experiment in kinetics. So what I want to do is give an overview first, because we've had so much of the theory before starting the experiment. It's kind of nice that I don't have to explain it all at the same time. So let me take some of the theory that we've done to give you the backdrop of this experiment that we're going to do. And the name that we normally call this is the iodine clock experiment. So in lecture, you know that if we were to know the stoichiometric equation for the rate-limiting step of a reaction, then it is possible, and I'm talking about simplified kinetics, then it's possible to come up with the rate law of the reaction. But if we don't know that rate-limiting step, suppose we only know the overall stoichiometric reaction, then we don't have any way of automatically knowing what the rate law of that reaction is. And today in lecture, we talked about one method of coming up with the rate law, which is to measure the concentrations of reagents over time, focusing on one reagent at a time, and tracking how the graph of that concentration versus time looks, either that or the log of the concentration or 1 over concentration. So that's the method of the integrated rate laws. Last week, you got an introduction to this thing known as the method of initial rates, which is somehow or another, you try to calculate what is the rate right at the beginning of the reaction, and then we change the concentration of each one of the reagents individually to see, does it have an effect, and if it has an effect, what kind of an effect does it have? So the iodine clock experiment, the whole point of this lab is to determine the rate law of a chemical reaction using the method of initial rates. Now, just to review a little bit of what I said a moment ago, it's only those reagents that participate in the rate-limiting step. So only those reagents that participate in the rate-limiting step normally affect the rate of reaction. If you have thoroughly read the chapter, you know that there's a little bit more complicated kinetics towards the end, where it talks about effects of equilibrium or having a really slow first step or second step, and we may get to that after the exam. But Most of the kinetics we've been talking about is well-behaved, where there's a clear, simple rate-limiting step. Now, just let me write down what I said about the method of initial rates. In the method of initial rates, the concentrations of reagents used in a trial, in each trial, are individually varied. To see what effect changing the concentration has on rate. So, there are more than one reaction that's listed in this procedure, but there's the main reaction that we're going to be studying in this case. And it's a reaction of the iodide ion in the form of potassium iodide reacting with this S2O8 anion, which in the text is called the peroxydisulfate ion. Those two things react to form the triiodide ion, along with sulfate as a byproduct. Oops, let me fix this here. So this is the reaction being studied in this experiment. So, we have a total of 4 moles of reagents stoichiometrically participating. But we haven't yet heard of a reaction step where 4 molecules can all participate exactly at the same time. I never had an in-depth introduction to kinetics outside of my normal, advanced but still considered normal chemistry courses. But one thing I remembered clearly from undergraduate, at least at the time that was being said, is that anything over a ternary reaction is really rare, and even ternary reactions are very rare themselves. Trying to get 3 molecules all to somehow interact simultaneously, not the normal case. So we could guess there's probably not 4 molecules in the rate law, meaning it's probably not 4th order. So just to emphasize that, this is something I've said in lecture, there's no connection between an overall stoichiometric equation and the rate law. So please take your screenshot so I can move to the next page. And like I said, there is no connection. Between an overall stoichiometric equation and a rate law. And why is that? Well, because the stoichiometric equation doesn't show how many steps there are. It just shows how many reagents are participating. And not just that, it doesn't show you which one of them is a rate-limiting step. So there is no connection between an overall stoichiometric equation and a rate law, since the stoichiometric equation does not indicate how many steps occur. Or which step, if any, is the rate limiting step. So to reword it slightly, but to emphasize why we're doing the experiment, in this reaction, since only the stoichiometric equation is known, that is why an experiment must be performed to derive the late law. And so that's the overall introduction to the experiment. We have this experiment that has two different reagents. We don't know which ones or how many molecules of each one are involved in this rate-limiting step. But if we start out with a reference reaction, where we start out with a set of concentrations, and we then measure the rate of the reaction, and then take one concentration and change only it, and then see what effect that has. And then we go back and change only another concentration. And we do one at a time in order to figure out, first of all, does changing it have any effect? Is that reagent even in the rate law? And if it is, then what order is that reagent in the rate law? So now we got to get a little bit more into detail, because if we're talking about rate, we have to talk about how to calculate rate. So, what is rate in chemical reactions? I know we just did this in lecture, but someone remind me again, please. How do we determine what the rate of reaction is? What is rate defined as?
The change in concentration over time.
Okay. And maybe it makes intuitive sense, or maybe it just needs emphasizing, that if we're comparing rates of reactions, that means we need to be as careful as possible that every condition in the reaction is kept as much the same as possible to reduce any variables that might affect that reaction rate. So, what change in concentration would it make sense that we measure? Well, it's one of the reactants, maybe, one of the products. But more the point is, wouldn't it be best if somehow that amount of reaction that's happening, you could call it the extent of reaction, shouldn't that be the same every single time as well? And if it is, then there's maybe an okay parallel for that. Which, I was glad that the track student that I know of wasn't in the morning section because I was talking about running around the track, which, yes, I can still run. I was never a competitive athlete or anything like that, but, you know, we had to run around the track in PE. And you might know that on a track, even if everybody starts at what looks like the same position, well, a track's curved. So the ending lines may appear to be in different places, but actually it's the same amount of distance traveled. And so in that analogy, everybody runs the same distance, And whoever wins is the one that does it in the less amount of time. Well, what if we did something similar here? What if we could somehow control how much reaction was going on in every single trial? And then all we needed to do was find out how long that trial took, and it'd be easy to do a comparison of rates. And that's exactly what we're going to do. Now, it gets a little complicated from there, but at least I'm giving you a background of how are we going to calculate rate. We're going to tie rate to concentration of some substance, and we're going to be really clever. You know, as students, you all probably wouldn't get it, and even if you could get it, it'd be like, oh, it's just chemistry. But for the chemist, thinking about how this experiment's designed, it's actually a pretty slick thing that there is a sneaky way we're going to be able to control how much reaction occurs every single time. So it's like a control in our language of like a control and hypothesis and all those things you probably learned back in elementary school. So to put some of this on electronic paper, in order to measure the rate of a reaction, there must be a measurable change in some concentration. Ideally, to equally compare each trial, the same amount of concentration change should occur for each reaction. And by analogy to a race, each trial will run the same distance. So the rate can be determined simply by how long it takes to reach the finish line. And that's a important conceptual point in this lab. There's the idea that we're doing the method of initial rates. That's its own concept that we've already talked about in class. But a detail of that process is how do we control how far each reaction goes? And so that's what I'm going to start to describe now, which is what are the chemical reactions that occur? And what is this creative way that the extent of reactions being controlled? So please go ahead and get your screenshots. And now we're going to start talking chemistry. Here are the three chemical reactions that occur in this experiment. And I'll give you a brief description of each one before I go and then tell the more full story. So the first one is the reaction we're studying for the rate law. And this is going to annoy the people that like to count atoms, but I wanted to at least show the identity of the reagents. Because, okay, first, who can tell me what a counter ion is? I knew, thank you. An ion on the counter. Captain, load the ion torpedoes for that one. No, a counter ion is something that simply balances charge. It's kind of like a spectator ion in that it doesn't participate in a chemical reaction, but you can't have a bottle of just anions. And if you look at the way that this reaction is written in the experiment, it's written just as anions because it's the net ionic equation, the bits that matter. But, and I know we're not in a lab, but just to honor the fact that we could have been in a lab, what are the true reagents we use? Well, it's potassium iodide, and it's ammonium peroxidisulfate. And they react to form the triiodide ion. Oh, wait. There we go. And as a byproduct, sulfate. Now, how come I didn't write the counter ions in for the products? Well, because we have three potassiums and we have two ammoniums, but we've only got this I3, and it's because it's a redox reaction, and it doesn't really matter, to be honest. So you couldn't easily write the products because you'd have to write a variety of the counter ions. But what is the point of this reaction? The two reagents. Because this equation contains the rate limiting step being studied in this experiment. Now, what's our next reaction? That triiodide that we just made turns around and reacts with sodium thiosulfate, an ion that you might recognize from Chem 1A as part of your redox titration lab. And it performs the same function here as it did in that lab. Thiosulfate is a reducing agent. Which, that brings up a curious question. What would be the oxidation state of triiodide? Think on that one. So anyways, we get three iodides back out, and we get this byproduct that I call, based off of one of the lab procedures, the peroxidisulfate ion. No. That's the other one. This is the tetrathionate ion. Tetra meaning four, thio relating to sulfur, and eight from the fact that it's a negatively charged ion. So tetrathionate. What is the purpose of this reaction? It turns out this is the one that controls the extent, the rate of the reaction. Now, No, I'm sorry. I said the wrong thing because I got a text that distracted me. Not the rate. It does not control the rate. It only controls the extent of reaction. And so that's what we would be related to this distance that we have to cover, or the finish line, whichever of those concepts you like. And we'll turn. I'll come back in a moment to how that works. Then the third reaction, that is another reaction of triiodide, which is with starch. Now again, last quarter, if you, which I think most people in here have taken the DeAnza 1A, again in that redox titration, to visualize that titration, because there's no true indicator, you use starch to color iodine that was present. But really, it was the triiodide ion present that ends up reacting with the starch to make a complex. So, this complex is a dark bluish purple color. And that is the whole point of this reaction. This reaction turns the mixture an easily visible dark color. Is the oxidation state negative? Oh, someone is actually trying to solve that triiodide, which is unfortunate because I'd have to think fast enough to give you what the true answer is, which is the fact that not all three iodines are the same oxidation state. So since the instructor brought it up, let me go to a separate page here. So, right, they don't have the same oxidation states, because if you look at this, triiodide, OMG, I'm flashbacking to Chem1A now, because we have three halogens, each of which would have 7 valence electrons given its position on the periodic table. 3 times 7 is 21, plus the fact that it is a negatively charged ion means it has an extra electron, so it ends up having 22. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22 electrons. That's all the ones we need. If you did this calculation in terms of formal charge, you're going to end up with the two outer atoms being neutral and the inner atom being negatively one charged. Because this is a compound, no, because this is not a compound, because this is a substance composed of only one type of atom, which means each bond has equal electronegativity, then the oxidation states end up being exactly the same as the formal charges. So in other words, the two outer oxygens are zero in oxidation state, and the middle oxygen is negative one. Yeah. Okay, so we were talking about the three types of reactions that are going on. Now, let me highlight, and I went a little color crazy this morning, but it does help because this triiodide is the product that gets made in the reaction that we're studying, but it shows up in these two other reactions as well, and that's why it gets confusing. So the one that's key is the second reaction, because that's the one that contains the thiosulfate. So the purpose of thiosulfate is to consume the same amount of triiodide in each reaction as it is formed, in each trial as it is formed. So just to continue the highlighting, it is the thiosulfate that matters, again, because it's related to the product of the reaction that we're studying. And we're going to come back to that when we get a preview, because we won't have time to do them today, really, when we get a preview of the calculations. So now, what about this third reaction? So the point of that is that we make a complex. So we have the starch, another one of our reagents. And I'm going to rewrite the reaction arrow I wrote there to make it more correct, because forming this complex is very reversible. And so even if the triiodide somehow reacts with starch to make the complex, it's going to still be able to react with the thiosulfate, which means that it's going to get destroyed, which means the solution doesn't actually change color. And that's an important point. If all we did was reaction one, we wouldn't see anything. And I think I said it so many times this morning, that's why I haven't said it enough this afternoon. Potassium iodide is a clear solution. Ammonium peroxide disulfide is a clear solution. Triiodide without starch is clear, as so is sulfate. So you have clear and clear reacting to make clear and clear, which means there's nothing to be seen. And so without some kind of spectrometer, in other words, using spectroscopy, unless we did something like that, we wouldn't be able to determine the concentration, or we did some other kind of a voltage measurement or something. So then we need reaction three. But if we only had reaction three along with reaction one, then as soon as reaction one started, out comes the color. Because you make a little bit of the triiodide, and that's going to react with the starch. So that's the point of reaction two. Reaction two eats up the triiodide until a set distance has occurred. And then you run out of thiosulfate. Now you make some extra triiodide. Now the reaction turns color. So the triiodide can be destroyed even if it forms a complex with starch.
Is the screen frozen?
I believe it is now. So, the triiodide can be destroyed even if it forms a complex with starch. And how did I word it this morning? Because formation of the complex is reversible. Now, I didn't leave myself much room here, but let me see if I can sneak one final statement in here. Which is what I said earlier. No color change will occur. Until all of the thiosulfate is consumed. And that means the color change indicates the end of the trial. What I'd like to do now is describe how this reaction is actually performed. So what you're seeing on the page is two tables that were taken from your experimental procedure. And there's a mix of several reagents here, several of which, of course, we've already identified in the reactions, and a couple of which we haven't. So let me give you a key to these reactions. First, notice at the tops, you have the original concentrations of the reagents, but we're mixing all these things together. So I want to point out, first off, because I'm anticipating the calculations later on, that we have all of these are volumes. So they're volumes, not the true concentrations. Because even if it says, for example, 0.012 molar up at top, well, it's going to be diluted once you mix it with everything else. So that's going to be one part of our calculation. But one important thing is that each one of these trials has the same total volume. Now, what's the set of reagents that we have participating here? Well, in green, we have the things directly identified in reactions 1 and 3. So these would be the reagents related to the rate-limiting step. And then what do we have otherwise? Well, we have the sodium thiosulfate, which, remember, that controls the extent of reaction. Now, why are these two separate tables? Because in real life, we mix everything up in two separate test tubes. Because again, if we mixed everything together right away, it just starts reacting. So we keep the potassium iodide, one of the two main reagents, separate from the peroxydisulfate, the other main reagent, until we're ready to begin the reaction. Then what else do we have? Well, for lack of a better word, the word I came up with this morning was placebo. In other words, reagents that are just there as space filler. And why do we have such reagents? Well, I'm going to summarize this at the bottom of the page, but what I said earlier, that in order to make the most effective kinetics experiment, you want to try to keep as many of the variables controlled as possible. And one of those variables, it turns out, is ion concentration. Now, this is a topic you don't learn until later, but there's something known as colligative properties, properties that solutions can have not due to the identity of what's dissolved in solution, but how many particles are floating around in solution. So, if we're changing the concentration of one of our reagents, then we balance that concentration change by something else that's effectively a spectator. So in pink, these represent unreactive reagents that are present to maintain, the same total solution volume, and the same overall ion concentration. And the whole point, what I've alluded to earlier, is that in kinetics experiments, it is critical to eliminate as many variables as possible. So that's again why we try to maintain the same total solution volume, why we try to maintain the same solution ion concentration. Now, looking again at these tables, this is only one set of reactions that's done, because the only thing that's being changed is the potassium iodide. Well, and its dummy reagent, the nitrate. You notice the peroxydisulfate is maintained the same for all the trials in this set of tables. So this would be a set of reactions to investigate just whether and how potassium iodide affects the reaction. And then I'll talk about some of the other sets of trials we're going to do later on. Now, how do we really do this? Like I said, you prepare two different test tubes, and in real life, I think it says something like, pour the test tubes back and forth three times and then let it sit. Which, if that's what it says to do, you want to do it exactly that same way every time. But a little bit more controlled experiment would be use a piece of equipment that you might not have used before, which is known as a magnetic stir plate. So many of you may have used hot plates before. And if you have, many of them are models that have two knobs on them. And one of the knobs is for spinning. And what that does is underneath the surface of the plate, there is a magnet that's on a rotor. So in other words, it turns. And it's a powerful enough magnet that if you take a small magnet and put it on top of the surface, it'll force that small magnet to move around as well. So what you do is you put a beaker on top of the stir plate, put the small magnet in the beaker, and that forces the solution to stir without there being any physical contact with the stirring mechanism itself. It's really cool stuff for mixing solutions. The fancy models, you can control exactly how fast they spin, which would be, in my mind, a better way to control how the reactions performed. So that's just a commentary on how we perform the reaction. Now, the last thing that we have time to talk about today is just getting into how would we calculate rate. And while we're looking at this page here, again, observe the part that's highlighted in blue, because that corresponds to the thiosulfate, which is what controls the extent of reaction. So that means that the thiosulfate, it doesn't control the rate of the reaction, but it controls the stoichiometry of what's going to happen. So if we're trying to measure everything to the same extent, and everything is controlled by the thiosulfate, it would make sense that thiosulfate should be the basis of any of our stoichiometric calculations. So let me show you what I mean by that. So all the trials react to the same extent. Which is controlled by the amount of thiosulfate present. Therefore, it makes, like I said earlier, it makes sense that thiosulfate should be the basis of any stoichiometric calculations. So in other words, we could say that the rate is equal to this, the negative change in the thiosulfate concentration divided by time. And that negative, that's what I stumbled over this morning, that is due to thiosulfate being consumed. And you might say, well, the triiodide's getting consumed as well. Yes, but from the perspective of the reaction we're studying, we're making triiodide, which is then consuming thiosulfate. So that's why there's a negative in this case in the expression. And as good as the expression is, there's one small problem with it, which is this reagent is not involved in the reaction with the rate-limiting step. So it would make more sense to do some kind of rate calculation based off the equation we're actually studying. So now let me rewrite this equation that thiosulfate participates in. So remember, it's triiodide reacting with thiosulfate in order to produce iodide and the tetrathionate ion. Now, there's a stoichiometric relationship between these two things. One triiodide reacts with two thiosulfates. So then because thiosulfate controls the reaction extent, it can be used to determine how much triiodide was produced. And that triiodide is involved in the rate-limiting step. So we can rewrite this as rate is equal to the change in triiodide over time, which is positive because it's a product, and it's equal to, well, it's proportional to the change in thiosulfate over time. Now, we need a negative in front of that because the thiosulfate is being treated as a reactant, and we need stoichiometry because the thiosulfate is being consumed twice as fast as the iodide is being produced. There's a 2 in front of the thiosulfate in the stoichiometric equation. And so there's a negative 1/2 that goes there. And that's the main part I wanted to get up to explaining today. Now, one last comment, that if the extent of reaction is the same in all of the reactions, then the quantity I just circled here this quantity is the same in all trials. So we could rewrite the rate as an expression like this, to say rate is some kind of constant divided by the change in time, which is what I've been saying all along in this experiment, that we're going to treat it right like a race, and because all the reactions are going the same distance, all we have to do is look at how much time it takes for the reaction to occur.